This is an interview with Bruce Hanley this morning for the Shoe Workers Oral History Project. It is December 12th, 2006. We're in the Bates Mill Complex in Lewiston, Maine. I'm Rachel DeGrozier, who will be conducting the interview. Along with us are Roger Natto, who also worked in the shoe industry, and Jessica Dumas, who is our new museum assistant. We'll start, Bruce, by asking you, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Lynn, Mass., which was the one time the shoe city of Massachusetts and probably the country. History of that city was pretty, you know, shoe business was big there. Not only the shoe business, but the tanning, leather was a central to up until probably the World War II was pretty much a shoe city. And then GE moved in there, and GE was kind of took over the shoe workers, went into the like aircraft engines, turbines. So GE was the big thing. And at that time, probably just before World War II, was a shoe capital of Massachusetts and probably the country at one time. My father worked for United Shoe. My mother, before she got married, was a stitcher for one of the factories in Lynn. My brother worked in the tanning industry. I worked in the tanning industry when I was a kid. And this is something I mentioned earlier, that when I was about 4 or 5 years old, my next door neighbor was in the shoe industry as a supplier. And when I was a little kid, I used to go next door and wind, for 3 or 4 years old, wind stripping. And his wife would give me a nice big molasses cookie.
And what was this stripping used for?
Shoe. Stripping, you know, binding, you know, you used to wind it on rolls and stuff like that. I remember as a kid, I'd wind the binding or stripping. And then he was still in the, he was an old timer then, Mr. Peterson, or Patterson, I guess his name was Patterson. So he was in the shoe industry probably back at the turn of the century, because he was an old geezer then when I was a young kid. But anyways, that was my first part of the shoe business. So I started, I think, young.
So where did you go? So then you went to school.
Yes, I went to the University of New Hampshire and Boston University. But between that time, I was in the service. I went to Korea, and where I was over in Korea was a shoe section or shoe. You know, when they were still, you know, after the war there, they were still manufacturing some shoes there. So I didn't do anything with them, but I was still involved with shoes, I guess, because I was stationed right in what they call the shoe area for the Korea. Then I came back home, finished school, got my Bachelor of Science in Engineering. And at that time, while I was in school, I worked at Falcon Shoes parent company on maintenance while I was in college. And my wife was executive secretary to one of the executives at Eagle Shoe. So my history goes back with her, and I could talk with her about different machinery, because she audited machinery and machinery parts and stuff.
Your
like
wife.
Nancy did, yes. And so I could talk about an Ensign Lacing machine, which is called an ELO. And she'd know what it was talking about. Mm-hmm. But so our history goes way back in the shoe business.
So how did you get to come to Lewiston?
Well, Ted, like I said,
or Robin.
Ted was at Harvard Business School, and he and I, well, we were looking for another place. The factory in Massachusetts was having problems, you know, getting people to work, so we were looking around for another area to start another factory. So, at the time I was working at the factory there in Everett, Mass. It was called Eagle Shoe at the time. It still was. Then I went from there. We, Eagle Shoe, started a small factory, a pilot factory for a spin-off factory for something different. We were making men's shoes in Massachusetts at the Everett factory. And we wanted to go into boys and what we call little gent shoes. So I started, helped start the factory in what we call Raleigh, Mass. It was a small little factory. It originally was a, what they call it, 12 by 12, but it was one of the first shoe factories in Massachusetts years. This goes way back to 1700s. The factory itself is still there. And we started a factory there for for boys and gent shoes. And that's how I started. And that's, we got going there to start a business. Hired a salesman. And that's, we started selling shoes out of there. Hopefully finding someplace else. So Teddy and I traveled all around the eastern part of this country, from Maine all the way down to, I believe we were down in Carolina. But we finally ended up here in Lewiston, Maine, because everything was here. Workers, supplies, tanneries, the whole shoe business was right here in Lewiston. So the mill, Continental Mill, was available at that time. It was empty. Well, in fact, when we first moved in, the mill still had textile machinery there. In fact, they were, when we started moving in, they were just moving out some of the textile machinery. And Bob Roy, God love him, he was there, had that huge mill, and we were the only people in it. And we started in, well, we started in the summer of, I believe it was 63. And when we really started to move in, it was cold. And Bob would be standing there. We were on the fourth floor on the farther wing, furthest wing from where the furnace was, and he would be pumping coal and cold as heck, and all those trucks coming in. We're the only people in the mill. It'd be heating the 20,000 square feet for us. But anyways, I can remember Bob, this might be kind of going off the record here, but I can remember Bob standing on the fourth floor and looking out the window and the dump trucks coming in with coal, soft coal. I mean, these huge trucks. I'd say, penny for your thoughts, Bob. He says, I wish you could give me a lot more. Because, I mean, tons and tons of coal were going in there just to heat our little section of the building. But then we started from there, and it went to, the rest is, I guess, history, because we started out with that one little section, and eventually we had the sixth floor for warehouse, we had the fifth floor for molding department, fourth floor was lasting and stitching, second floor was offices, the third floor, so we had
shipping.
And shipping was, that was, at the time, was the sixth floor, the shipping. With it, remember Al?
Right.
So.
So the workers, the workforce, and whatnot, kind of convinced you
was
a major.
Oh gosh,
aspect
yes.
Of
oh,
it.
We had.
What was it about the workforce? Was
great. I mean, people here were. Let me tell you, I came from a tough workforce in Massachusetts. They were tough. Okay, they. I don't know whether I should say this or not, but very unionized, okay? So you couldn't do anything without calling, a co-committee together. If you want to bring in a new machine, you couldn't. That's why the reason we started the other factory. We could bring in new machinery. Couldn't do it there without starting with a force of, one guy would have to check the machine. If we had a line of 10 or 15 guys, each guy would have to have so many weeks on as a test. Well, there's no way you're going to be tested machine for a year just to. So that's why we started the other factory. And that's why we came up here. The supplies were here. The people were here. just about everything was here. Great people. In fact, we used to have tests for different parts of the factory for
new machinery.
Also for people coming in. We had, you know, it was back when we first started. It was a lot of chances for people to, you know, to well, at the time it was textile business. Well, Continental had closed. This Bill of Pates was starting to, you know, go down too. So we had a supply of people at that time too. There was some factories here, shoe factories that were starting to slow down also. But we had business and we were able to we went from just a handful of people. At one time we employed over 500 just workers, not salesmen. Probably maybe office help and 556, close to over 550 people at one time. You know, we have our payroll. So,
can you talk about the makeup of the workforce? I mean, as far as backgrounds, education.
Sure can.
What ethnicity they were? Were they pretty well one, all the same, or did you have?
Let me tell you, that was an eye-opener for me. 99.9% of the workers were French, spoke French. Every one of my superintendent down to the every foreman could speak French. I couldn't. So I had a
So great how did you communicate?
Roger.
Through management.
Right. That when we first started. That, let me tell you, then most of the people there were not highly educated, but they, hand-wise, for running machinery and stuff like that, no better place. And they were good workers, they were there every day. One of the things that amazed me too is when we first started, most everybody could walk to work. Most everybody walked to work. They were all from right around here. And that was the amazing thing. I think I had one or two foremen that had cars. The rest walked to work. Bobby walked to work.
So you think that most people didn't have their homes as much as lived
no.
in tenements?
Or? Yes. Oh, yeah. Little Canada. And yeah, oh, definitely. Yeah, there was. And then at the very end, you know, when we. Most of those people, well, you know, Roger, we all had, they all had, look at the bosses. They're all the kids, you know, college graduates. I sent their kids to school. 99% of the, after a few years, they were all pretty well educated. I mean, it's almost a, you know, 180.
Complete turnaround
is right, yeah. And we started out with the computers. We went from, the old-fashioned sewing machines to highly computerized. We were the first computerized stitching and joining shoe factory in the world, not the country, the world. We developed the what we call the automatic computer stitches with United Shoe. I sent an engineer down there for probably six or seven months just to work with United Shoe to work on computer stitching. So anyways, that was a big thing with us. We probably spent, even our injection molding machinery were state of the art. We had to buy stuff out of Europe. In fact, I used to go to Europe every other year for the machinery shows just because over here, shoe business was starting to, get smaller and smaller, and most of the machinery is made either in Germany or Italy. And we had exotic machinery, and we had our own mold shop. We made our own molds for soles. We were pretty much self-sufficient.
What about the workers? Did they get along? Was there strife?
No.
Not going to what it was.
We had a good we never really had any real problems. Well, I think we took pretty good care of our people, didn't we, Raj? Huh? I think so.
Did you find that other than working together, did they socialize a little outside of work?
We used to have some good times. We always out to camp we always had big parties and Christmas parties and stuff like that. And I think we always had good times.
Was there a special way of getting special jobs, or did the job get put out and anybody could apply, or did you go search out people, or?
Most of the time we, from within, but as we started to expand, we had to hire from outside, so you did get a lot of outside people. At the time, we went from, like I said, almost zero to 500, so that's a lot of people. And a lot of our people were right out of high school, or even, a lot of come down out of Canada, too. We used to have when we first started, a lot of Canadians, they would come down, and I was thinking of some of our, even our foreman, Canadian. Cookie, you're Canadian, right?
Even in 1963, they'd come down to work in the shoe shops.
Yeah, believe it or not, yeah.
That's interesting.
Howard Gaylord.
We had not a lot, but not like back in the 20s or 30s, but we did have Canadians.
Did you have, outside of management, were there certain jobs that was looked down upon or looked upon as a favorable job or better job or?
Like anything, yeah. Yeah, we had all kinds of jobs. And if some people, they were geared to the job, so to speak. I mean, they might have not had college education, but we had, in fact, some of our guys that looked like a roller. I don't think he finished high school. Look what he is now.
Rick Campbell.
That's us, yeah.
Great example.
Yeah. 90% of them. A lot of them had no high school education, and they all ended up pretty darn good. Making good money.
Yeah.
So.
Did the workers feel comfortable offering suggestions or being inventive on trying to do things better and so forth, or did they depend on management to tell them?
No, we used to have brainstorming. We'd take a shoe, and depending mostly the foreman, but sometimes the workers, we just break a shoe down and see, how can we improve this? The competitors or our own? And a lot of times, even the workers would say, can we do it this way? Let's give it a shot. So, I think we were that way.
We had a reward program at one time for suggestions.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I forgot that.
You had a rule for that.
Yeah.
Okay. Were the workers, did they find the work hard, or I went to take pictures with Roger, and there was an 80 or late 70-year-old woman there, and I asked her when she started working in the shoe industry, and she said 16 years old, and she's in her 70s or late 70s, and she's still working, and she wouldn't think of
Janine Roy. My goodness, Janine, she had to be a teenager when she started. She's still there today, and still one of the better. I don't know.
I was amazed.
Some of those girls were great.
So is that
when they got married, a lot of them left for a while, and then they'd come back. They'd come back after they had the children, they'd get grown up, and so we had a lot of that too. And that was amazing things. You know, someone would come back. We've had, one of the things that we would give lessons after work, or knock off maybe an hour or so early, and we give some of that did not have a high school education, so we give them, you were in that garage, GEDs, right? I can remember one girl, she decided that this might, you know, after she got her diploma, she went to work for some, you know, into an office. I don't think she was gone a month, was she? And she came back, well, a couple times this happened, you know. Came back, well, money was better. And it was manufacturing, and it also was a more camaraderie with the, better than the bank or an office, you know,
Did you have anything that you used in the shoe industry that that had anything to do with the river or discharging anything in the river or that you remember of? Or did you use anything like that? Or
no, we didn't know. We had no, most of our was internally. Steam and everything was internally. We generated our own. No, I can't remember anything. No, there was no discharge. Not to my knowledge. I can't think of anything now.
Okay.
Though we did have chemicals. We did. Shoe industry had chemicals, but we were pretty, OSHA and that type of thing. We always had inspections. Our insurance people were pretty careful with that, too. You know, that, after a fashion, you know, it was probably during our heyday when things like that, where the environment was very important. So I always considered us pretty good neighbors, so to speak. No, we never had any problem with discharge of unfriendly environmental stuff. So no, but we did have chemicals.
You mentioned when you first started the business that there were other shoe shops. Can you talk a little bit about what the competition was like when you first started? Were there a lot of other shoe shops? Were they in Lewiston? Were they in Auburn?
Auburn.
And then as you went along, can you talk about how that changed?
Well, we probably, I think we were survivors. We survived. Some of them didn't. A lot of them didn't. In fact, Falcon is the Lone Ranger, so to speak, you know. It really, and I consider that one a pretty lucky thing. We always found our niche. We started out with little children's. We went to men's and we developed the unit, what we call the unit sole. We developed the unit sole down in Massachusetts, and we brought it up here. And that was kind of unique at the time, especially for children's shoes. We developed what we call PVC, which was polyvinyl chloride, which was injected molded. And we went to urethanes, which was kind of unique, which at the time, we were probably one of the first making urethane soles. And again, the machinery to do that was in the millions of dollars. So plus the fact, once you bought a machine, and the machine would be, like this table, and each place had a mold in them. The molds could be from $10,000 to $30,000 a piece. And each size had to have a mold. So, very intensive, investment, big investment. I don't know how we did it, to tell you the truth, but we did.
So it was your inventiveness of being able to foresee what was happening and be in the forefront to carve out your own niche survived.
I think that's a good point there, because both Ted and I were engineers. He was an engineer, and I was an engineer. And 99.9% of the shoe companies were started by salesmen, okay? So we had the manufacturing end of it. I think. We weren't salespeople. In fact, we'd have a hard time selling a shoelace, I think, maybe. But anyways, we were one of the first ones to have conveyor lines, like the, in the shoe industry. And actually, we used to have a lot of people from all over the country come to see our places, like Brown Shoe and International Shoe. And in fact, Ted and I traveled all over the place. That was one of the things. We were always invited to some place, and we'd give them information, and they'd come to see us, and we'd give them information. But we had a good rapport with the rest of the shoe industry. I think we did, anyways. There was a couple places that may not let us in, those people were always, we figured we were ahead of them. No, I think that's one of the reasons the place is still going. It's still, my son is over there now, and he's an engineer, and I guess we tend to engineer the business. Business was basically engineering, wasn't sales oriented. It was engineered, mm-hmm. So we were able to make them, and we would find our own niche. And hit that. Like I said, we went from little boys to big boys, little boys, what we call little gents. Then we went to boots, or work shoes and work boots and safety shoes. And now they're even making. I think they're one of the few places in the country that make leather fireman's boots. They're not rubber. They're leather. And back when that was one of the last things I was working on when I left was developing. With the tanneries right here locally in the state of Maine, helping working with them to make fireproof leather, and we did develop it, and that's what they're using right now over there. One of the few places in the country. I think it's the only place. To tell you the truth.
Mm-hmm. Good. What about? Do you have a feel for how the family was organized? I mean, was there an order in the family? Was there overall general
amongst the workers?
Amongst the workers and their own families.
We had a lot of wife, husband, kid, children.
Teams?
To work. That worked for us. Quite a few. I'd like to, that would be a good thing to investigate how many families we had working for us.
I would say right now, off the top of my head, that we had at least 15 husband and wife teams doing, when I say teams, I mean, them being a team, but they did separate jobs, one worked in the stitching, the other one in cutting, lasting, so we had that many, husband and wife.
Who was the boss in the family?
I'm going to take the fifth on that.
Well, we find that in the textile industry, it seemed like the woman was the one that handled the affairs of the family, and the husband most of the time, she's the one who took care of the household and paying the bills, and the husband would come in and give the paycheck. And
I hate to tell you, I think that's what happened in my family. No, I would say it was, I don't think it was even Stephen. I wouldn't. Though the women usually were the dominant. They could be the dominant ones.
Can you speak a little bit about the community itself in general? When you first started versus how it changed?
Very much. Yeah, I would say. It was very, like I say, it was oriented to the families and the church, and definitely was a French. And now, I think as it got, near my end of my term, I would say that things changed. I don't know how much, but at the first of it was definitely, family oriented, revolved around the community. It was very close. Like I said, a lot of them didn't even have automobiles.
Yeah.
And so it was here, within the community, the clubs. In fact, when Ted and I first started, we spent time here across the street. There was
Pasta.
And also at the restaurant there.
Cedar
Street Lunch. In fact, I forget the fella's name was the cook there. We'd be working late at night, and maybe just before they closed, Teddy and I would run over there, and we'd get all the leftovers. You just fill our plate up, so we could eat once a day, and that was it. But who the heck? Well,
Nell,
and who's the other cook there? He was a great guy too. But anyways, we always had a very close relationship with everybody. I got along with everybody here. I think I did. Anyway, I know we did. It was a good time. I can think of some of the people that were peripheral to our, like the patent people, like Bobby, you know, Bobby Caron, God love him, Jay Liz, you know, Bobby and some of the other people that we had very, the Verrall brothers. I mean, we were close, we worked very close with them, the Verralls at Diamond Machine. They would come in to us. Well, in fact, we had one of their first conveyors. All the new conveyors that we had were always developed by them. In fact, stuff is still over there today that they developed. And we, you know, worked great with Bob and Roger and Dick. Great people. That was one of the things too. We had super help from those people. They would come in. I mean, we'd be there late at night, and those guys would be here. We would be working, trying to figure out stuff out, how to make this work. And as a result, a lot of stuff that they developed with us would be found in other parts of the country. A lot of things that we developed over here, they pushed off. You know, they were able to sell it in other parts of the country. You know, the Verrall boys were super duper. Well, the Jones and Viney people, we worked with them quite a bit. A lot of local people that were here, we always worked pretty good with them. And I think that's one of the things for us, how successful we were. These people helped us a lot. They went out of their way for us, you know. In that respect, it was, I think now, some of the people were great. I mean, I can see Bob and Roger Verrall. I mean, we'd be there at midnight working in the factory, you know.
Yeah.
And they'd be there, you know, giving us ideas. Roger writing down stuff. Bob smoking a cigar.
So what happened then? You talk about when you decided to let go, or did you decide to sell the, or
yeah.
Did you decide to retire, or did you?
Well, I kind of, things, well, I guess the business was going overseas, a lot of it. So you had to kind of make a niche. And One of the people that were the Iron Age people had an in with the General Motors, Kodak, and they had what they call these trucks and vans that went to these businesses. In other words, if it was a General Motors or a Ford plant or something, they'd bring their trucks right in. And that's when we started making safety shoes. So they had an in there, which no way in the world you could ever, but the Iron Age was a good size outfit. And so we were continually giving, making shoes for them. And finally we got to a point where they said, we need more. Well, that meant you had to upgrade. And we just decided, it's a big decision. So they said, well, we're going to find somebody else, unless you sell. So that's what we did. So we sold to them. And they were good. They were good to us. They kept us supplied. And as a result, they were able to put stuff, and we were able to develop new products for them. And as a result, as things escalated, the costs of doing business escalated too. I mean, a lot more than when we first started. You know, you couldn't get away with a little, a $10 sewing machine. I mean, our sewing machines would cost us $85,000, $50,000. I mean, big bucks. And then if you wanted to upgrade your sewing machines, those were in the million. So you had to have some backing, and it was not an easy task at the time, especially with when we were making children's shoes. In 1 year, we went from 700 to dozen a day, and then Chinese or the Koreans came in. It made a big difference. I mean, Zippo. So that's when we switched over to it was one of our tracks over to Europe. And at that time, the Germans were doing big things with what they called urethane. And so that's when we started getting into urethane for men's boots. And we took over Dunham boot, which was we made for L.L. Bean. We had some of the best, companies in America. We were very fortunate.
So foreign competition did have some major effect on the shoe industry.
It killed our children's business. I mean, we went from 700 dozen a day or something like that. I forget now, but we went from that. The next year was almost nil. I mean, that's how fast. And you take your big companies at the time. You take the big companies, and they all went overseas. Sears, Walmart, any of those. Well, one of our biggest was Moore's Shoe. They went. I mean, we filled the bottom of the warehouse there at the Continental Mills before the Easter for children's, and then maybe in the next year. Zero. I mean, that's just how bad it went from. The only reason it saved us, we were able to jump up and find that niche in the men's market. So, and we were able to, we had our mold shop. We had the mold shop up in the sixth floor of the Continental Mills, and they were able to, push stuff for us, which we could design a new sole because they were integrated with us. We could get it, whereas if you had to go outside, the mold making was going overseas, so you had to get in back of some of the big guys. So we had that was one thing. We had our own mold shop, so we were able to put new styles in like that. So that was a plus.
Good. Is there anything else that you can think of that we haven't covered? You can think of that sticks out. Was there some major event happening or?
I think probably the computer stitching, which enabled us to do some things with that nobody else could do. And the only reason we were able to do that is we had an engineer down at United Shoe for probably 6 or 8 months, solid. He stayed down there and worked with them, and we come back to us and we work it out, and as a result, they became United Shoe. That was one of their biggest lines, was the computer stitches. Probably, and between the computer stitches and the injection molding department, we probably had the knowledge, best knowledge in the country, probably the world at the time. There was not too many people we couldn't beat, you know. If we got a go ahead and we got some orders, we put it in. A lot of times we took some chances, and I think that's why we were successful in that respect. We would take a chance. But we did have, like I said, we did have good help. We had the supplies were all here at the time, and of course today it's a different story, but yeah, a lot of stuff has gone overseas.
You talk about having good help. Do you remember some of the benefits of the programs that you offered to your employees?
Yeah, well, when we, that was, of course, I was up in the state house, so I got involved with some of the stuff that, but especially health insurance. When we first started, we offered health insurance completely paid. We offered insurance for life insurance that was all paid. And we had a few more benefits that, you know, we always gave them a bonus and stuff like that. But I think we paid them pretty good. We paid our people pretty good. Things as the government got more involved with us. One of the biggest things was the workman's comp. Workman's comp went from a few thousand dollars, well, not a few thousand. It was back in maybe the late 60s. Not too bad. I mean, it was, you could afford it. Then all of a sudden it goes to 20, 50, 60, quarter of $1 million for insurance. Some, you know, unreasonable. Whereas we used to fight for 5 and 10 cents for to save on a shoe. That would come through and you know, your pay for your insurance. That would cost you, you know, 10 times that or more. Then the government got involved. One of my biggest problems was with the government was, and especially the state government, was OSHA. They had different. I would go out west to big companies like Brown Shoe and some of the big companies out there that, you know, they'd ask me, Bruce, I would say, gee, you know, your OSHA, you get fined for this? They'd look at me cross-eyed, for heaven's sake, saying, what are you talking about? So even though they were national laws, they were interpreted different here in the state. And as a result, it would cost you more money. I can remember, this is probably not even worth talking about, but I can remember.
It's important.
I can remember, of course, Continental was an old mill, right? And I'll never forget, the nurse come in, and she decided that the doors to the women's stalls were too high. So I was supposed to change all the stuff. And if not, you got fined. And we just put all brand new lighting in. And we had an electrician come in, and from OSHA said, well, you got to put another wire in. It's things like that. I mean, it was unreal. Some stuff was unreal that I considered unreal. But it was an expensive proposition to do business. It still isn't. The state is an expensive state to do business in. It really is.
Good.
But one of the things that, yeah, I guess insurance was always a headache that you had to, you know, it would hit you when you least expected it, and you're trying to make, trying to compete with the rest of the world, and state feds made it high.
Good. Well, I think we had a good interview. Gives us a little insight, and we'll put it with the others.
Okay.
Go from there. We really appreciate your time coming down.
And thank you so much for inviting me.
We'll go from there.
This was there. Bostonian. We were first, then Bostonian, then a fellow moved over from Kaushu. He started his factory there. Roger, who was... For the guy from... class shoe when he came home. Remember he had to the third floor? What was his name? Shoe factory. And then the guy that did the hand whip.
Billin Shoe?
Billin, yeah, Billin Shoe. And then on the second floor, who was on the second floor did the hand whips? His name is... Hi-Ho Silva. No, so, yeah, so, well, this is...